Welcome. This is the UX Design Cast podcast series, and my name is Carl Vredenberg. This is episode number 23 in the series, and the format we're using today is a tutorial format, and the title for today is Trends in Design Disciplines. And I'm delighted to have on the session today with me Julie Santilli, who's a visual designer by training, and she is IBM Visual Design Community and Tools Lead, and she's located in Toronto, Canada. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, Carl.
And we also have David Schwartz, who is an interaction designer by training, and he has responsibility as IBM User Interface Architecture, Patterns, and Assets Lead, and he's located in Seattle, Washington. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Carl.
And last but certainly not least, we have Bob Jones, who is a UX practitioner, and his responsibility at IBM on my team is as the IBM User Experience Community and Tools Strategy Lead, and he's located in Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Carl.
Well, thanks so much for being on this session, all three of you. And we wanted to focus during this session on really the changes that have been happening in the way that user experience design is carried out due to a number of different directions and technologies and development practices and a variety of things that really have been introducing changes in the way that practitioners of the disciplines that we are talking about and with here. And we wanted to go through a summary of what we see as some of those trends, what kind of impacts those trends have in the ways that designers and user experience people need to sort of change and adapt and optimize the work that they do. So we wanted to do this in this kind of order of starting with looking at user research, then following that up by looking at the trends in interaction design, and then followed by visual design, and finishing up looking at user evaluation. So if we start with user research, maybe Bob, you can give us your thoughts on the trends in that area.
Well, thank you, Carl. I think as we've discussed in one of our prior podcasts on agile development processes, the focus on providing a description of the primary stakeholders for your application is one of the key focus points of agile development processes. And here I'm specifically referring to sort of the principals, the people who make the purchase decisions on the product, the end users, the people that are actually working usually on the glass with your applications, the deployers who are often responsible for installing, configuring, and getting your application out to the end users, and then the development team themselves. And for three of those stakeholders, you know, one of the methods that many of the development teams are using in agile development processes to describe those stakeholders are the use of personas. Now, personas are basically a very short description that really factors in a number of aspects about each one of the targeted user groups. Typically has a name associated with the persona, a photo, a description, and conveys a lot of the high-level goals and tasks, as well as communicating some really emotional information about that specific stakeholder to help establish some level of empathy with the development team. And that includes things like, you know, pet peeves, hobbies, life goals, what they do in and outside of their job. And so, you know, it's the use of personas that I think we've really seen ramp up with especially the focus on agile development.
So personas, and people refer to them using a variety of different words in terms of persona, persona, personas, and so you can take your pick, I guess. But the benefit is this notion of really summarizing succinctly a variety of characteristics about a user population that can very easily and succinctly be described in these fictional, but yet, you know, fairly accurate characterizations of a typical kind of user, right? And the way that that's communicated is, as you say, in a form that you could have, as we talked about last time too, a description, a little poster, a card in, you know, a cubicle of everybody on the team that everybody can keep on their minds, the actual targeted user or users that they're designing and developing for. So that's, I think, a really good example of something that I think, you know, a number of years ago, we wouldn't have seen quite that, and certainly not used as heavily and as, I think, effectively as we do today, right?
Yeah, and I think you touched on a couple points that are very important to emphasize, Carl. I mean, first of all, this is a fictional persona. These people don't actually exist. However, they are based on primary user research. The information that feeds into the development of the persona is often based on interviews with typical users, web surveys, talking to subject matter experts in that area. And so basically this information, this primary research is consolidated into this fictional persona. One of the other things we found is that it is possible to reuse a lot of elements of personas. So, for example, if you have a very similar position that you know uses the same types of user roles that occur for example, different products, it is possible to reuse a lot of the core elements of those personas. However, you know, even in those cases, we like to do the primary user research to validate that. And I think one of the great examples of reusing personas is in the area of accessibility. We within IBM have developed a persona which describe various roles that might be filled by persons with disabilities. So we actually touch on a variety of different disabilities and how those might influence those individual persona. And, you know, some of those key attributes of those persona can actually be incorporated into other products personas.
I have to say that personas, in my experience, can be just tremendously effective. Something to keep in mind, however, is that you have to keep them current. They can become stale. So if you have personas that are based on these research you carry out in a business setting, you know, business is very fluid, and their systems and structures change. The technological environment within which people are working change as well all the time. You know, obvious example is, and this actually has an impact on or reflects changes in interaction design, is the introduction of mobile platforms. So the fact that users, the vast majority of users, actually in this country at least, in the United States, are now accessing the internet from multiple access points, not just desktop, not just mobile devices, but multiple access points. You need to factor those evolutionary aspects into your persona. So you always have to go back and ask the question, you know, does this persona really reflect the current state of affairs for our target user population?
And it probably makes sense to reinforce too, I think, probably, David, that not only do you need to keep these current and also reflect, as you say, new use, but you also, this doesn't, you know, obviate the need for doing appropriate user research too, right? In terms of doing things like contextual inquiry and all the kind of techniques that are still in the kit bag for user experience practitioners, still need to, you know, gather the information in a form that then can be converted into and summarized and described and then reused in a really nice package in the form of these persona, right? Is that the way that you'd see it, Bob, in terms of the way to see primary research in terms of understanding users and then mapping that to persona?
Yes, Carl, and that's a point that we really cannot overemphasize that, you know, reuse of certain aspects of the persona is certainly valuable, but it does need to be supported by that primary user research. Now, yeah, I think you mentioned a number of a very classic sort of user experience techniques, you know, including contextual inquiry, user interviews. We could also use web surveys to gather a lot of this information. And some of our teams within IBM have actually been, you know, looking at perhaps more innovative ways to gather this information from the user groups. One of our teams recently created a Facebook entry for their persona and used that to gather feedback from customers on, you know, what are the typical characteristics of this persona, and in fact validated some of their higher level objectives and goals that way. So I think that, you know, in addition to some of the classic user experience, you know, user research techniques that we can use to gather this information, we can also look at, you know, some of the more new innovative ways to gather this primary research.
That is quite an innovative way of collecting that information and very effectively using, as we've talked about in previous podcast episodes as well, you know, using some of the social networking tools and systems that are currently, you know, being used by many, many, many people, right? So a really good way to actually get to a lot of people that would be able to provide you input and feedback on things like the feedback on persona would in fact be to, you know, leverage where people's eyeballs are actually staring. And a lot of those eyeballs are staring at things like Facebook and Twitter and the like. So, you know, really, really good input there. Why don't we move next? We've talked a little bit about, you know, what's been going on in user research, and we'll come back to that in a bit too. And we've talked a little bit about the impact of that in new ways of working in interaction design, especially in the areas of, you know, getting to new platforms like the mobile platform and some of the challenges that it involves. Wanted to go next to, you know, visual design. Visual design is probably, you know, among the disciplines and the results of that discipline's work that is becoming, in my view at least, you know, incredibly important in terms of overall success of the design of systems and the like. And so why don't we go next to Julie? And Julie, maybe you could just describe your sense of what the trends are in the area of visual design. Julie?
Well, thank you, Carl. First, let me talk about three overarching trends. The first trend is the stakeholder requirements. Stakeholders being customers, end users, internal product management, and their demands are increasing significantly. The second overarching trend is the role of the visual designer. Our role is increasing in terms of responsibilities and skills, and the scope of the work is changing dramatically. And the third trend is in visual UI design, specifically focused on cinematic effects, style, color, and imagery.
Okay, why don't we go down and discuss maybe a little bit of those. So the organized it in terms of sort of the impacts on and stakeholder kind of requirements, and then down to the actual trends that in the design sort of attributes itself. I think that's a great way to organize it. Why don't we talk about the stakeholder sort of trends first?
So let me elaborate the stakeholder requirements. Our customers have told us through surveys that approximately 50% of their decision-making in terms of purchasing is based on the look and feel of the product. That's exciting, really, from our perspective, knowing how much they value the overall user experience and the success of the tool. But then, of course, it adds that extra level of that fantastic design challenge that our product development teams have to meet. Our end users are definitely much more design savvy. They want more functionality, more features, and they want more wow factor via the behavior and visual effects. And our internal stakeholders, our product development management team, executives, etc., we look at the competition, but not only just the competition, we look at all the current and new technology directions that are happening all around us, like social networking systems, the virtual world, and so forth. And so therefore, we want not only to ensure that our designs are intuitive, but really and beat the competition, but leapfrog everything that is out there currently in the UI space. And as consumers, all of us are surrounded and seduced by all levels of latest technology, gadgets, interactive media, and we want that same experience built back into everyday tools that we use. We also want all of our electronic devices that we use, our desktops, mobile devices, etc., to all be synchronized together, work well, based on the features and functions within each of the different instantiations of that software and reflect what our needs are based on the context of use. So as you can see, the demands from all different areas within stakeholder context, right down to even ourselves, has increased.
So Julie, are some of the kinds of things that designers need to deal with? I mean, I hear people inside and outside IBM asking for, you know, visual designers to come up with designs that are sexy and trendy and glossy and all. I mean, there seems to be, and I would imagine there would be a lot of pressure on designers to react to coming up, you know, with designs that satisfy those kinds of requirements. I mean, first of all, is that what you're hearing too? And if so, how do designers react to that? And how should they deal with the increasing sort of demands now, you know, on their design work? I mean, just if I look back at, you know, the role of the designer many years ago, and it was really sort of the graphics designer and not fully a visual designer, you know, was on kind of production graphics, creating icons for many, many years. When we did, you know, just desktop type UIs, that was sort of the focus. And then when the web came around, it was basically taking what was known in print design and then taking that and sticking it on the web. And it still didn't have an awful lot of difference in the ways in which, you know, people did design. But now we've got all kinds of new directions and trends, and designers are being asked to do obviously an awful lot more than, you know, coming up with the icons for an application. They're really creating the overall sort of personality, the overall style, the overall branding for an application or tool or website. So the importance has really been increased in terms of the visual designer. I think there's also been a lot of increasing demands on the skills for those designers as well. But when you get those kinds of requests for, you know, coming up with trendy, coming up with sexy kind of designs and the like, what's the best way to, you know, approach the reaction to that?
Well, let me first start with the terminology. Our customers and sometimes our internal stakeholders, they'll give us terms to reflect how they expect our product to be designed. They'll use the words like cool and trendy, and just based on that alone is not sufficient. Does cool mean the color scheme, or does it mean the transparencies from the UI perspective? Or is it just a word that is used as a jargon for everything? Or is it a thoughtful aspect of the UI that we inject? Is trendy the latest gadget or the widget that's being used as a selling mechanism? So these terms really need to be clarified. Where are they stemming from? So I always recommend to be careful of interpreting them on your own and need to have some supporting rationale behind them. You know, the word trendy itself is not timeless. But if a product decision is to add elements that are attractive to the target audience and with the understanding that this design may not bode well in 2 years from now, then it's fair enough to say that we want to put some level of trendy aspects into the design itself for the purposes that it's trying to meet that market share today, but also augment it with some level of classic solutions that support the long-term timelessness of that product. We are very comfortable with recognizing what clean and simplicity is, but it's also important, as I said, to get some more supporting rationale behind the simplicity and clean design term that's being reflected in our information that comes from our customers. When we get feedback from our users, people have, you know, typically have gut reactions to good design. And again, that is hard really to describe. How do you, sometimes you have a gut feeling that you have, it's an emotional reaction. So it's important for us to take their user feedback into consideration. It certainly is very important, but make sure it has some supporting rationale behind it and relying on the user expertise within the development team to do an analysis of that feedback so that therefore is a good balance of the information coming from the users as well as the expertise within the design team to deliver a good design that has a big picture vision for the long-term future of the product and also meets the needs of today's audience. Now let's move on to the role of the visual designer. I believe that the role has changed in parallel to the wave of the technology changes that we've been seeing over the past couple of years. And there's been a definite momentum towards the value of the visual designer in the overall product development team. And this is, again, an exciting opportunity for all the designers to really embrace this role and the responsibilities that are given to you. We have two areas of focus as a designer. It consists of both the aesthetic focus, which is our traditional background experience, as the creative aspects that we can provide to the UI. But there's also two, now more so, is the functional focus. And that, again, is a shared experience with the whole product team, but certainly from the visual designer perspective, that is an increased responsibility area that is very important to our job. It's sort of the base work before we even get to the aesthetic focus of our work. Let me go into more detail. The role of the designer takes on many hats. They're the choreographer, the storyteller, the film director, and sometimes a UI developer, focusing on developing the JavaScript for a welcome experience. And of course, if you're working in rich internet applications, you'll be the owner of the style sheet, as well as the continued responsibilities as production designer, information designer, and sometimes info architect. Wearing all these hats can be quite exciting. It can be quite a juggle to do them all at the same time, but they all do tie in together directly to the final experience that you want to deliver. In some cases, the designer may actually lead some of the design direction. Other times, they may be sharing the skills with the interaction designer in areas of wireframing, prototyping, and documenting the UI guidelines. On the side of the aesthetic focus, we continue creating highly visual and attractive intuitive UIs. We're always pushing the UI style to the next generation. We want to give it a level of quote-unquote branding, so almost a style that others will follow. We always look at color trends. It's always important to us and important to society in terms of color, because it's an emotional appeal. And in the context where people are working 24/7, color is very important to create a level of calmness, cueing, etc. Interesting enough, this year's color for 2009 is named Mimosa, and it's been called out as the color because it conveys hope, which is the way we are feeling today's society. Okay, there's also cinematic aspects that have become now almost mainstream, but it continues to evolve. And these cinematic aspects are in the areas of animated effects like fade, slide, twirl, zoom. And that's not uncommon in the movie industry. You start to see it into PowerPoint presentations, and now it's being brought right into the UIs. And this will continue to evolve. And lastly, on the human aspect, you know, we want to make sure that the UI is engaging, creates an engaging experience for the user to like interact with it at an emotional level while they're working on their software for a long period of time.
Now, when we are thinking then and reacting to, you know, the requirements you get from stakeholders, Julie, we just talked earlier too about the notion of and the importance of persona and knowing, you know, what type of audience are we designing for, what type of application it really is in terms of the tasks that are supported and all that kind of thing. I would imagine that designers now are required to address an awful lot more, as we're talking about here, of requirements than they used to, but they also probably have to, you know, weigh the input that they get. So they may well get a stakeholder saying you want some sexier or trendy design, but what you really need to also do, which is also what you're saying, and I just want to amplify it, that you use the information that would have been collected from the user research work and that is instantiated in, for example, the persona descriptions, to be able to know whether a particular design, a particular combination of colors and effects and you know, reflections, or you know, the variety of all the choices that the designer has to be able to design that overall kind of personality of the product, that they'd be really trying to design for the preferences and sort of the appropriate approach to building something for the audience itself, right? So you can't be designing everything the same way, even if you're designing something that is essentially a toy versus something that somebody uses every day for their primary business, right? So I would think that that's also an additional thing to reinforce, that the designer needs to really work and leverage the knowledge that they would have had made available to them from some of the work that we're just talking about with regard to user research as well, right?
Yes, we certainly listen to our customers, and we are designing for our customers first and foremost. You know, we may have feedback from a customer that has a gut reaction to good design, but we also have to take into account that they may not have some real rationale why this should have a certain level of good design. And it's up to the responsibilities of the designer to really to look at the whole. It's really looking at the whole product. You can't just look at the glass part of it. You have to look at the whole experience itself. And whether you've got, you know, your stakeholders with the customer or internals, you know, saying they want a sexy design, then you have to sort of say, well, what does that really transcend itself down to? We're always seeing so much visual information these days that, you know, at many levels, different types of media to levels of industrial design and all that richness that we're encountering these days is expected in our UIs. The fact that you are spending 24/7 using this particular application, how do you create that level of appeal? How do you create that level of interest and engagement with the user as they work on this particular application? There's ways you can create that perception of it being enjoyable and sexy, if you will. If you take an example of the carousel cover flow widget that was designed, and now Apple owns that particular widget, and that whole experience, there's a level of playfulness, you know, the notion of bringing back kind of childhood memory, shall we say, given that it's the carousel metaphor itself, but it engages the user, it provides them with a level of browsing quickly, it's enjoyable, a good experience, but you're still getting through a particular task fairly quickly. So there's that level of interest with the experience that the user may have while they're doing a task.
It also strikes me that there are kind of trends in, you know, it used to be the case that you would design applications, design websites, and that was sort of, you know, a website or an application would have sort of a design of its own, and there was really not a lot of similarity across all of them as a group. But if I liken that to kind of the fashion industry, the fashion industry introduces in any particular year, you know, what the colors for the year are, what the kinds of attributes are of fashion. And, you know, this starts off in Europe typically and is influenced, you know, across the industry from, you know, a few design houses. It strikes me that the IT industry has, and the electronics industry has sort of adopted a similar kind of approach, you know, where you now have fashions in design, you know, whether it's, say, you know, reflections, you know, whether it's, you know, a glossy, you know, kind of black surface, you know, the variety of kind of techniques and, you know, visual flourishes. And some of these are also, you know, animations or cinematic effects, as you referred to earlier, Julie, that there seems to be at any one time in fashion set of these. And, you know, some companies just, you know, flat out just copy whatever they think are the, you know, the entire set of these, while others appropriately and I think more judiciously realize that, yeah, that is the trend and you should be using some elements of that because that's really what a lot of, you know, users and customers are expecting. But at the same time, you know, putting their own personality, their own, you know, brand image on it as well. And so I wonder if you could just talk a little about your perspective on, you know, this whole kind of fashion trend area of focus within, you know, designing the kinds of things that people are who are listening to this podcast probably also are dealing with every day.
I think it comes from a number of levels of influence. Traditionally, we looked at fashion, the clothing industry, definitely for color. And then we looked also to the architecture and industrial design of cars, of shapes and styles, and the simplicity of design itself. Now, within the last 10 to 15 years now, we've got more exciting product designs being developed in the IT industry, more so where people are looking at the IT industry for the direction and design, specifically Apple. And now that we've got kind of a social networking and the open internet space where everybody can post their designs and post YouTube videos now, we've got all kinds of collaboration happening, and it gives people the opportunity to then showcase their skills, whether they be a visual designer or interaction designer or developer. And through this kind of means of sharing of information, that this is viral effect happening when someone creates a design, it gets posted on the web and people pick up on it, and a trend starts to become common. That now, you know, it can come from anywhere. The trend can be started, or design or fashion can be started So now we've got a lot of IT trends, a lot of IT fashions now, if you will, that people are looking to and expect more and more these days, especially since, you know, with the advancement of technology now, to embrace a lot of visualization of information, a lot of gaming in context now, bringing it to a host to home, not just for the gamer itself, not just for the kid who's 10 or 12 years old or the 35-year-old, but really right into our daily environments now, so that it's exciting to see how that shift is happening. You've got, you know, people who are traditional color experts that, you know, will still provide us with the next trends in color in 2 years from now. And we still look to those people as direction because they really have an eye for that particular specialization. We have to all be conscious of our social environment now, you know, in terms of what's happening, both in the economic conditions and also too with, you know, green, but not just the color anymore, but it's a new social consciousness. So those kinds of things are taken into account when we're designing our UIs. And as designers, a responsibility that we have to embrace and engage with all those types of different levels of fashion statements or trends that are happening within our world.
Now, it strikes me too, Julie, and I wanted to sort of get back to also talking about user evaluation as well. I think the notion of these various trends also has led to companies just sheer trying to copy the trends or the designs of others. And there have been a number of instances in the industry that we've seen more recently. We've also talked about in our panel podcasts within this overall series too, where the copying of a particular design doesn't necessarily even work all that well because they may not have picked up all the details appropriately, which reminds me that, you know, one of my favorite soapboxes about doing user evaluation work and user research work is that, you know, we've got a bunch of rules of thumb that have been around the UX, you know, business for a long time, you know, having somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 6 to 8 users in for a user study and a usability lab. And, you know, that's all you'd need to get, you know, feedback on your product. Well, yeah, you need that in order to identify the most serious user problems of being able to actually carry out tasks efficiently without errors, right? A lot of people, I think, make the mistake of assuming that visual design and visual design feedback is the same. And in my view, it couldn't be more different because visual design is not a matter of necessarily yielding problems of not being able to work with a particular design, but it's more one of preference. And so in order to get the right feedback in that kind of environment, I've always advocated that you don't and you can't be collecting, you know, really serious and valuable feedback on the visual aspects of design, especially the ones that have to do with preference, using some of the traditional, you know, UX methods. You need to be using much larger scale user studies, whether you're doing things like surveys, getting feedback on preferences of alternative designs and visual treatments, as well as using massively larger equivalents, tool-based remote study equivalents of a traditional small sample, you know, user study. Anyway, I just wanted to make that point because that's certainly a hot button for me. I wanted to also just get back to Bob Jones again too and talk about any other trends that are happening in the overall area of user evaluation. Bob?
Thanks, Carl. You know, I think you hit on some of the key points right there. I think that there will always continue to be the need for the type of diagnostic, problem identifying one-on-one usability studies that have, traditionally taken place in a usability lab setting, and we're increasingly doing more remotely now with our customers. They don't actually have to come to our usability labs to participate in these usability evaluations. But as you said, you know, these continue to do a great job of identifying the key usability issues that you may have with a particular application. But it really doesn't get at the sort of larger scale data that you need to really assess, you know, whether your customers are going to, you know, like this at an emotional level, and what their satisfaction is going to be like. So one of the things that, you know, I think we're seeing an increasing use of are, you know, usability tooling to support, you know, remote evaluations, particularly these large scale evaluations where you don't even have to be participating as a UX practitioner in real time in the evaluations. These are becoming, you know, increasingly popular with the use of the rich internet applications, browser-based applications, and of course, you know, they're certainly applicable to evaluating, you know, websites and the visual design aspects of all of the above. Whenever you can get, you know, a large number of users to participate in evaluation, and there's a variety of tools available today which support that. Tools such as User Zoom and Keynote all provide these capabilities. But it allows you to not only get these get this feedback from a large number of users, but it also allows you to get it from across different geographies as well. You know, we're increasingly focused on having our applications available to users in other geographies and in their native languages. And it's often difficult, you know, within the close proximity of the development team to locate, you know, users who are proficient in those languages. So this is one of the ways that, you know, we can expand our focus and get that feedback from a variety of different users.
Now, speaking of those kinds of trends and the fact that we're also talking a lot of the time now not about, you know, desktop applications, although they still exist. We also have mobile applications, as David talked about. We also have web applications in the Web 2.0 world that are, as you mentioned, rich internet applications. So we've got this whole range. It's not like any one of these is going away particularly. We sort of have all of them. And some of the tools that you were just talking about are ways of collecting information in some of those new areas as well. And they also provide you, as you say, the opportunity for collecting larger sample feedback from, also very importantly, right across the world, various people with various abilities and disabilities, as well as in different cultures and geographies. And I might also just point out that it's also really important to get global feedback, not just on, you know, how well something is translated, because we're not only just talking about the notion of translation when we talk about globalization, but it's also really important to get preferences again from a visual design point of view right as well, because there are pretty dramatic differences in various parts of the world in terms of, you know, the preferences with regard to particular aspects of visual design. But I wanted to get back to David with regard to, you know, rich internet applications. This is an area that you're also heading up some work in. You know, this is a case where we now have, you know, huge capabilities in the browser for now being able to do what you used to do on the desktop. I wonder if you could just talk about that trend a little more.
Well, it's actually a very exciting trend that coupled with mobile, and they each present their own set of opportunities and challenges. If I might just go back to mobile for a second, you know, the challenges there, I think the opportunities for mobile are pretty well known. The challenges, of course, involve the fact that there's typically reduced display space relative to desktop computing. Generally, there's degraded data entry capabilities associated with mobile platforms. And at least for a large portion of the install base of mobile platforms, severely degraded or impoverished browser capabilities. So all of these factors really leads one to really underscore the importance of user evaluation and making sure that given these different issues, coupled with the trying to exploit capabilities that are unique to a mobile platform, such as localization services, integrating it effectively and on the fly with built-in applications such as context lists, really does necessitate the careful evaluation of these designs before they're deployed. With regard to rich internet applications, and whether you're talking about proprietary systems such as Microsoft Silverlight or Adobe Flex Flash or open source solutions based on Ajax, for example, they really do open up vastly greater opportunities for relative to what was possible just, you know, a few years ago. But, you know, along with these opportunities, there are that many more pitfalls that designers can fall into. To the extent that you can create a much more advanced and superior user experience using some of these RIA or RIA technologies, you could just as easily, if not more easily, deliver things that are very, very problematic for end users. And so, once again, just want to underscore that these kinds of trends really do lead one to really valuing and investing in thoughtful and careful user evaluation programs.
You make an excellent point, David, that I just wanted to amplify a few points that you made. That number one, you know, there are these new directions, the rich internet application capabilities that have all kinds of additional opportunities and decisions to be made. And some of them are, you could create something that is amazingly entertaining and but distracting as heck to carry out particular types of tasks. It may well be, you know, beautiful and interactive, but may not, you know, serve the need, whereas other things may be, you know, designed, you know, way too blandly. So the number of decisions, the number of opportunities for, you know, design and elements to build into design really have really increased dramatically. But as a result, the task, yeah, so the task of the designer is also tougher now, because it's tempting to go apply any of these things all the time. It's sort of like, you know, you see somebody put a presentation, set of charts together for the first time. And if the particular presentation chart maker from whatever vendor, you throw in, you know, a bunch of capabilities for putting in animation, you're going to put in effects and stuff, and you see some of these god-awful presentations that just are going crazy, right? And they miss the point of really the fundamentals of communication. And so the same thing, I think, happens in some of these other areas that even includes some of the mobile platforms. So there's more decisions to be made. And as you say, we need to again still rely on the tried and true but further enhanced, you know, user feedback methods that Bob has talked about today too, in really knowing what's right for the particular application and not just necessarily going on our own judgment. But I wanted to make one other point, and that is that these things are, as you say, burgeoning at an incredible rate. I think it's also important for any of the disciplines that we're talking about in this session to have personal experience with each of these technology areas and trends as well, in order to really know what to do in a rich internet application environment. You got to know what those kinds of best practices are like. And you also need to, you know, rely on best practices in the forms of user interface design patterns where they exist. And in some of these new areas, we're having to define new best practice designs. But in order to really come up with them in a really effective way, you need to have some level of experience with, you know, what works, what really is a pitfall, and whether that's the mobile, you know, platforms, whether it's the rich internet application, you know, ones that we're talking about, whether it's any of the new technologies that we're needing to design for, it really does require some level of contextual information in order to really know what the options are, what might be most effective. So I think an excellent discussion. David?
Yeah, and quite frankly, as a discipline, we're still very much learning about these new platforms, these new paradigms, which is really what rich internet applications represent, an entirely new paradigm. You know, rather than being page-oriented, for example, it's application-oriented. Well, there are implications that has for the entire user experience. So while we are evolving best practices with regard to these things, you know, you can anticipate that those best practices themselves are going to evolve rather dynamically over the near term.
Okay, well, we're getting really close to kind of the time that we try to set for these sessions, so I want to start to wrap this up. Just wanted to give anybody else that's on the call a last-minute opportunity to describe anything else that you'd like to leave those who are listening to this episode with in terms of the discipline that you're in and what kinds of things, either specifically with regard to that discipline or just keeping on track with and being aware of these new trends in technology and within disciplines. You know, any final advice from any of you in terms of what information you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Carl, this is Bob. You know, one thing I'll just say is that we're constantly inventing new ways to gather user research, to gather feedback, but it really doesn't eliminate that basic need to talk with your users throughout the entire development and design process. You know, I think fundamental behind all these, whether you're using personas, user stories, use cases, whether you're doing lab evaluations, web surveys, or large scale remote usability testing, the fundamental concept there is really understanding and working with your end users to ensure that the user experience you're developing, in fact, meets their needs and ends up being a very compelling user experience.
Very good advice, Bob. Anybody else want to contribute?
I would certainly echo what Bob just said, and it'll come as no surprise to anyone listening to this. But in terms of best practices with regard to design, the best thing one can do is just read, read, read. There are tremendous resources available on the internet, and lots of books coming out. So take advantage of it.
Very good. Julie, any final thoughts?
Yes, thank you. Several comments. First, the key is really to use your own tools you build, and therefore you become a user of it, you become familiar with it, you can experience the same challenges, the problems, do test case on it, really live and use your own tools that you develop, because it's a different case when you're designing for the audience that you're designing for, but you're not actually using the product yourself and not understanding the better designs you can generate. Second thing is to constantly tap into the latest technologies. Even for a visual designer, there's so many technologies that are being developed even at the level for the designers to embrace, whether it's tapping into the newest designs, directions, or helping us to build prototypes, binding all of our design tools that we have right to the implementation level of coding, and then also keeping abreast of the latest technologies and see how you can bring those technologies into your product and influence the direction of your product itself. And lastly is the continuation of working really well with an integrated design and development team, being at the table at the beginning. A customer doesn't interact with a product and separate the difference between the actual physical device itself to what the visuals look like to actually the behavior interaction of it. It's all one encompassing user unified experience. So you have to think as a team that way and share your ideas and be really willing to have the people who are perhaps can bring, like the developers can bring design ideas to the table, and you can bring technology to the table. So it's a good collaborative space to be in. We're always evolving and being innovative in a much more effective way.
Very good advice, Julie and Bob and David. And I might just add one other thought, and that is that one other very good source of getting information about any of the topics that we're talking about here is to go to our website, which is at ibm.com/design. And I'd also suggest that you follow the Twitter account that has at IBM Design as its name. And lastly, this podcast series has on it reviews of product designs, and we get into a lot of best practice from various disciplines' perspectives on there as well. We also talk about the news and updates and events that have happened each month in our panel discussion format. And we also have interviews with design leaders from companies right across the industry on a periodic basis as well. So I would suggest that also is a good source for keeping up on the various trends that we're talking about in this session today. So that's it for this particular episode of this podcast series. I want to thank Julie, David, and Bob for their participation in this one. And very importantly, I want to thank all of you who are listening to this today for your attention to this topic and listening to this podcast episode, and also encourage you to subscribe to the entire series. And you can do that by going into iTunes, going into the iTunes store, and going into the search box and just searching for UX Design Cast as one word, and that'll take you to the UX Design Cast page, and you can then select subscribe, and then you'll automatically be getting episodes from this series directly in your iTunes and also directly into your player, whatever that may be in terms of an iPhone, an iPod, etc. So that's it for this episode. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you all next time, and bye for now.